TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Technology and Globalization. Nuclear Weapons in Space and Space Junk. Jacqueline Cabasso and Bruce Gagnon. The end of the Cold War has not led to a reduction in the nuclear arsenal. On the contrary, one of the most surprising facts about the United States budget is that today, more than $5 billion a year are spent on research for new nuclear weapons. And those $5 billion are just for nuclear warheads. The delivery systems are a separate line item. Some of these new nuclear warheads are designed to be used in and from space. Jacqueline Cabasso heads the Western States Legal Foundation. She is their executive director. Andy Kimbrell from the International Center for Technology Assessment was moderating this panel. Here's his introduction to Jackie Cabasso.
Our next speaker is Jacqueline Cabasso. She's been involved in nuclear disarmament activities at virtually every level for over two decades. Since 1994, she's participated as an accredited non-governmental organization representative in nine negotiating sessions at the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty and Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. And she's going to talk to you about the Abolition 2000 Global Network to Eliminate Nuclear Weapons. She's the co-author with Susan Moon of Risking Peace, While We Sat in the Road. And she's going to talk to a little bit about an old technology, but one that is unfortunately still very much with us, nuclear weapons. Jackie.
Thank you very much. Although the title of this panel is The New Role of Military and Space Technology, I want to start out by talking about the current role of some old military technology that unfortunately is still very much with us, nuclear weapons. This old technology is fundamentally intertwined with the military and space technology of the future. Some of you may be surprised to know that the U.S. is currently engaged in a massive program to build up its nuclear weapons infrastructure and is currently designing more usable nuclear weapons hand-in-hand with other high-tech weaponry. It is important to note that this is not a partisan development. It is a continuation of policies begun under the Truman administration and carried on through every administration, Democratic or Republican, since. On December 30th, Mikhail Gorbachev, the last president of the Soviet Union, published an open letter to President-elect George W. Bush, in which he boldly warned, "While America's role is acknowledged throughout the world, her claim to hegemony, not to say domination, is not similarly recognized. For this reason, I hope, Mr. Bush, as the new American president, that you will give up any illusion that the 21st century can or even should be the American century. Globalization is a given, but American globalization would be a mistake and even dangerous. For 10 years, U.S. foreign policy has been formulated as if it were the policy of a victor in war, the Cold War. Need an example? The expansion of NATO eastward, the handling of the Yugoslav crisis, the theory and practice of U.S. rearmament, including the utterly extravagant National Missile Defense System, which in turn is based on the bizarre notion of rogue states. In fact, 10 years after the end of the Cold War, the military political establishment in the United States has regrouped and has fabricated a new set of justifications for retaining nuclear weapons as the core of its national security policy, while refining them for greater utility in the changed international context. Most Americans seem to believe that nuclear weapons simply vanished into thin air when the Cold War ended, but nothing could be further from the truth. According to a 1995 study by a committee of the U.S. Strategic Command, although we are not likely to use them in less than matters of the greatest importance or in less than extreme circumstances, nuclear weapons always cast a shadow over any crisis or conflict in which the U.S. is engaged. Thus, deterrence through the threat of use of nuclear weapons will continue to be our top military strategy. Approximately 2,300 U.S. strategic or long-range nuclear weapons remain on hair trigger alert, ready to instantly target locations around the globe. In fact, since 1995, the number of sites on the target list has grown. Land-based nuclear missiles are ready to launch their deadly payloads within 2 minutes. U.S. Trident submarines continue to patrol the seas at Cold War levels, ready to fire hundreds more of the most destructive and precise weapons ever conceived on 15 minutes' notice. Trident submarines carry two types of warheads. One of them is the 100 kiloton yield W-76. And by comparison, the yield of the Hiroshima bomb was approximately 15 kilotons. During a June 1999 presentation to Los Alamos National Laboratory employees, Dr. Stephen Younger, the lab's top nuclear scientist, explained, "The W-76 is the backbone of America's strategic deterrent. There are lots of these things out there. They're out there right now on submarines. Submarines moving very quietly. We don't know where they are. The bad guys don't know where they are. 30 minutes, however, and they can deliver this type of weapon to just about any target on Earth. Okay? So the moral of the story is, don't mess with the United States. You think Texas is bad? Try a Trident submarine." End quote. In addition, approximately 150 U.S. tactical or short-range nuclear weapons are still deployed in NATO countries. And although it's almost never mentioned, over the past decade, the 1990s, the U.S. has threatened the use of nuclear weapons against Libya, North Korea, and Iraq. Through a massive program, euphemistically called stockpile stewardship, new nuclear weapons facilities of unprecedented sophistication are being built. A new generation of nuclear scientists is being trained, and nuclear weapons design and production is going forward. In fact, the U.S. is now spending more than $5 billion a year on nuclear weapons research, development, testing, and production, an amount in constant dollars well above the annual Cold War average for directly comparable activities. And that's just for the warheads, not the delivery systems. Under the current moratorium on full-scale underground nuclear blasts, nuclear weapons design will be advanced through simulations carried out using super-fast computers, coupled with archived data from more than 1,000 past tests and new diagnostic information and subcritical zero-yield underground tests at the Nevada test site. The Stockpile Stewardship Program also anticipates building new nuclear weapons production facilities in order to have the capacity to produce at least 450 new plutonium pits a year by the year 2020, a number that exceeds or equals the individual nuclear arsenals of China, the United Kingdom, France, and Israel. And the U.S. is also preparing to resume the production of tritium, which is radioactive hydrogen, the H in H-bomb. Under the Stockpile Stewardship Program, modifications or upgrades, including enhanced military capabilities, are planned for every weapon type in the U.S. arsenal. Last year, Undersecretary of Energy Ernest Moniz declared, "Our tools under stockpile stewardship are working so well today that we are not only able to certify safety and reliability, but we are also able to meet new military requirements." Despite official claims that the U.S. nuclear arsenal is being de-emphasized, research continues in the U.S. nuclear weapons laboratories on new ways to use nuclear weapons against a variety of targets. This includes a current congressionally mandated study on a new generation of weaponry, including low-yield mini-nukes for use against hardened and deeply buried targets, such as missile silos, stockpiles of chemical or biological weapons, or Saddam Hussein's command bunker. This is an extremely dangerous development because the military is likely to regard these low-yield weapons as more usable than existing weapon types. The initial phase of the National Missile Defense proposal to deploy missiles intended to counter missile warheads aimed at the continental United States is only a small part of a far broader set of initiatives for weapons and other military systems which would operate through and from space. Systems which would, to a large extent, share a common technology base and infrastructure. The U.S. is expanding funding for development of a wide range of space-based weapons, surveillance, and communication systems, including space-based radar, space-based lasers, and reusable launch vehicles. I can go on in great technical, boring, but deadly detail about the technical efforts underway at the nuclear weapons laboratories that are contributing to the development of this new generation of high-tech and space-based weaponry. This is not going unnoticed by other countries. The Russian National Security Doctrine, which was released in January of 2000, recognized what was going on and placed it in context. They said that the transition of NATO to the use of force beyond the zone of its responsibility and without the sanction of the UN Security Council, which has been elevated to the level of a strategic doctrine, is fraught with the destabilization of the strategic situation in the world. And this is the important part. The growing technological surge of some leading powers and their growing possibilities to create new generation weapons and military hardware are creating prerequisites for a qualitatively new stage in the arms race and a dramatic change in the forms and methods of waging hostilities. Civil society must begin to find ways of addressing the relationships between the various high-tech military technologies by refocusing attention on the enormous influence of the military, industrial, and academic complex. We must also understand that the drive for military supremacy is not happening only at the behest of major corporations, though they're certainly a major influence, but more broadly as a means of projecting pure power with political, ideological, and cultural, as well as economic dimensions. We will need a real peace movement which makes both conceptual and organization connections with emerging movements for social and economic justice and for ecological balance. And this movement must be grounded in a commitment to both nonviolence and mutual cooperation. The Abolition 2000 Global Network to eliminate nuclear weapons is one such effort. Founded in 1995, Abolition 2000, which works closely with the Global Network Against Nuclear Power and Weapons in Space, has grown to include over 2,000 non-governmental organizations in more than 90 countries. Abolition 2000 is calling for immediate commencement of negotiations to conclude a verifiable treaty on the elimination of nuclear weapons. I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
The next speaker is a veteran of peace and social justice issues. I've had the privilege of working with him in the past. Bruce Gagnon is currently the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. He is another activist and organizer, as well as being a great thinker. He spends 2 to 3 weeks out of each month traveling and organizing to stop the nuclearization and weaponization of space. Bruce organized the very important Cancel Cassini campaign opposing NASA's ludicrous attempt or campaign to launch 72 pounds of plutonium into space. Bruce began his career as an organizer with the United Farm Workers Union. Please welcome Bruce Gagnon.
Hello, everyone. It's good to see you all here. There's a man by the name of Robert Zubrin. He's a Lockheed Martin executive. He's also president of an organization called the Mars Society. He says that the Earth is dying, and that we have to prepare to move off this planet. He says that we need to move to Mars and to begin to terraform Mars so that we can start a new civilization. I want to know how many of you think you are going to be invited by the Mars Society to go live on that new planet. Any of you here? The Global Network was created in 1992 because we saw the train coming. We put our ears to the railroad tracks, and we knew what was coming. And so we said, we've got to build a global movement to stop this nonsense, this insanity of moving the arms race into space. The industry, the aerospace corporations, the weapons corporations, view space as a new market. But we think the time has come that the people of the Earth develop a new consciousness about the way we view space. Today, we view space as a junkyard. There are 110,000 pieces of space junk orbiting the planet Earth at 18,000 miles an hour, just larger than a half an inch, being tracked on the radar screens at NORAD in Cheyenne Mountain. The Space Shuttle Challenger, on its previous mission before its launch failure, had a windshield cracked when a tiny speck of paint hit it at 18,000 miles an hour. And the International Space Station being built just above the Earth at the price of $100 billion recently had to be moved to another orbit because they said space junk was going to hit it. In 1989, I organized a demonstration, one of many that I've organized, at Cape Canaveral, and our speaker that day was Apollo astronaut Edgar Mitchell, the sixth man to walk on the moon. And he said, if we allow the Pentagon to put weapons in space, to even test weapons in space, that we will create so much more space junk that we will not be able to get a rocket off the planet Earth. We will be entombed to this planet. You know, 100 years ago, we said that the lakes and rivers and streams of the Earth were vast and limitless, and we could pour raw sewage and industrial pollution into them because dilution was the solution to pollution. And that's now how we view space. But the time has come for us to declare that space must be protected like any other wilderness, and this is the new consciousness that we must develop. Every single launch today punches a hole in the ozone layer. And today there are 34 nuclear reactor cores launched by the United States and the Soviet Union since the beginning of the space program that are orbiting the Earth, powered by uranium and or plutonium, that in the next 1,000 years, these 34 cores are going to fall back to Earth, burn up on reentry, and spread their deadly toxins globally. It's important that we understand clearly who our opposition is. It's not just the aerospace industry, but it's also the Congress of the United States. One illustration is the April 1999 vote on ballistic missile defense. Do we deploy as soon as technologically feasible? Yes or no? And the vote that day in the House of Representatives was 345-71 in favor of deployment of ballistic missile defense as soon as technologically feasible. And you know, in the Senate, that is similarly divided as the House is today, the vote was 97-3 in favor of deployment of national missile defense as soon as technologically feasible. The corporations have consolidated their control over the Congress of the United States, and there's no doubt about it. Joe Lieberman ran for Vice President of the United States. He was at the committee hearings when Rumsfeld came before the Senate Armed Forces Committee for his confirmation hearings. And Lieberman said to Rumsfeld, "Mr. Rumsfeld, you know, in the last election, Al Gore and I promised that if elected, we would spend $100 billion more on the military than the Bush administration would." He said, "Mr. Rumsfeld, I want you to know that in poll after poll after poll of the American people, they do not rate military spending as a high priority." And Lieberman said to Rumsfeld, "We must work to change that." And there's another Democrat by the name of Joe Biden, senator from Delaware. He's come out saying he's opposed to national missile defense. But friends, there's a shell game that is now underway, because there are two different programs in the ballistic missile defense system. One is called National Missile Defense to protect the continental United States from attack by these rogue states. But there's another program called Theater Missile Defense that you would forward deploy on ships and on airplanes. The airborne laser with a laser beam in its nose, flying over the offending nation's territory 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and then ground-based launchers provided by the Army. Joe Biden is in favor of theater missile defense deployment that they say they will use to surround China, deploying it in South Korea, in Taiwan, 90 miles off the coast of mainland China, in Japan, our unsinkable aircraft carrier, as we call it, and in Australia. Missile defense is a Trojan horse. It's a way to sell this stuff to the American people, because they know they can't come and say, "We're going to be master of space. We're going to deny other countries access to space. We're going to control and dominate space." So they sell it as a defensive system when, in fact, it's not. The Pentagon has just announced, just weeks ago, that they are now going to build a space-based laser test facility at $30 billion in southwest Mississippi. The space-based laser, they say, will be the follow-on technology to missile defense. It will be the real Star Wars, the real Ronald Reagan Star Wars program. The space-based laser will be a constellation of 20 to 30 lasers orbiting the Earth, knocking out other countries' satellites in space and their ground targets on the Earth below, giving the United States full control and domination. And this is the poster of it. It's now being developed by Lockheed Martin, TRW, and Raytheon. You know, Russia is under control. Its economy is in shambles. NATO is expanding. We're encircling it. It's under lockdown. The IMF and the World Bank are moved in and really are going to take control of that country. But the one independent player in the world today, still outside U.S. control, is China. The Washington Post on May 26th reported that the United States will now embark on our program to manage China. And the United States, that article went on to say that we are now going to nearly double our U.S. naval presence throughout the Asian Pacific region. We're widening runways and lengthening runways on Guam and Wake Island for the B-1 and B-2 stealth bombers. We're now forward deploying cruise missiles onto Guam, and we're going to follow all that up with deployments of theater missile defense systems as soon as technologically feasible. But they have another problem. The United Nations has the Outer Space Treaty that says no corporation, no individual, no country can claim ownership of the planetary bodies. The Moon Treaty says there can be no military bases on the moon. No one can say they own it. The heavens are the province of all humankind and even beyond this humankind on this earth. But the aerospace industry is now moving to circumvent those laws because they want to be able to claim private property rights on the planetary bodies. And so they've asked Dana Rohrabacher, a right-wing conservative from California, to introduce legislation that will give them authorization to circumvent the UN Moon Treaty and Outer Space Treaty. It is not yet passed, but they're working on it. And they say it'll take a year to get to Mars, and by the time they do, the astronauts' bodies will be like jello because of space radiation. So we have to find a way to get there quicker. So they say they're going to create the nuclear rocket with nuclear reactors for engines. And so today at the University of Florida, in Gainesville, Florida, where I live, the Nuclear Engineering Department is working with Los Alamos Labs to build the nuclear rocket to Mars. And they say once they get to Mars, they're going to have nuclear-powered mining colonies and little nuclear-powered rovers driving all over the planet doing soil sampling and identification in preparation for the days that they begin mining. And the Department of Energy Laboratories that built the bombs, they're now viewing space also as a new market. And just 2-3 weeks ago, the Department of Energy came out with a new environmental impact statement saying we must expand plutonium production at the Department of Energy laboratories across the United States because of the growing demand for space nuclear power. And so at Oak Ridge in Tennessee and at INEL in Idaho Falls, Idaho, they say they will expand plutonium production. And that means that these places, there will be more and more contamination. You know, when they launched Cassini in 97, we said it's not just that we fear that rockets with 10% failure rates will have an accident with plutonium on board. The plutonium production process is a danger. Between 1994 and 96 at Los Alamos Labs, when they were fabricating the plutonium generators for Cassini, the Santa Fe, New Mexican newspaper reported that there were 244 cases of worker contamination while they were fabricating Cassini's generators. If the building of the bomb process was wrong because of the contamination to communities and workers, it stands that way for space missions as well. So what are we doing about all of this? We're trying to create a global debate. We have affiliate groups on every continent of this world that are organizing now to talk about space so that we prevent, in this historic moment we have, we're standing on the edge of a cliff, ready to go off the edge. For once in our life, we have a chance to stop a new arms race before it actually happens. Ultimately, these people are trying to bleed the people of the Earth. I believe they want to create a global slave class. They want to use, they say, space superiority so they can intervene anywhere on the Earth at any time. They say we can't put a Marine on every single street corner of the world, but with space superiority, we can intervene anywhere at any time. We know that since the first development of Star Wars to date, they've wasted $120 billion on Star Wars development. And how much of the missions to Mars, a whole series of them, takes a year to get there. Recently, I found in Space News a statement that said early estimates for the cost of the Mars missions ran up to $400 billion. Multiply that times 10 or 20. We're talking real money here, folks. I've coined a phrase to describe all this. I call it pyramids to the heavens. The aerospace industry are the pharaohs of our age, going to build these pyramids to the heavens, and we, the taxpayers of the world, will become the slaves in order to build these pyramids. Well, the time has come for the slaves to revolt. The time has come for the slaves to say, we're not going to move the arms race into space. We're not going to give you our programs. In that same Space News article, they said the way they're going to pay for these missions, they said, was to cut the fat and pork in entitlement programs. Well, I don't know about you, but after Reagan and Bush and even Clinton, which entitlement programs are we talking about here? Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and what's left of welfare is called AFDC that has a four-year limit in your entire life. These are the entitlement programs the aerospace industry says that they want to cut in order to build these pyramids to the heavens. I say the time has come for us to say, hell no. Thank you all very much.
That was Bruce Gagnon. He is the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. He has worked on space issues for the past 15 years. Bruce Gagnon and Jackie Cabasso were recorded by the staff of Hunter College at the Teach-In on Technology and Globalization, organized by the International Forum on Globalization. They were introduced by Andy Kimbrell, founder of the International Center for Technology Assessment. I hope you have a pen handy for more information. You can find links to the websites of the organizations mentioned today on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. You can get a copy of today's program on nuclear weapons in space and space junk with Jackie Cabasso and Bruce Gagnon for $12. That includes shipping. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Mariah Gallardon. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.